So, wir müssen es so machen.
Ja,
ja.
Wir eh nicht, ich fahre Auto heute.
Das ist kein Problem, dann trinkst du ein Mineralwasser.
Augenblick. Björn?
Okay, yeah, just press the this button. Yeah, it's very automatic. It's all manual. As you like, not more than two. So, my web page.
and I didn't get disappointed. So I'm so delighted now that I'm happy to spread the news and share my knowledge. So, what should this method be capable of? We've got, well, there are different clues how we find out from where a sound is coming. There are several directional clues. One is the delay of sound. If it comes from there, this ear is reached by the sound first, then that one. There's interaural delay. Fons just managed it in the other workshop. And important to know is that it works especially good in the lower frequencies. Then we've got the clue of where the loudest signal is, there comes the sound from. If it again comes from here, my left ear should perceive a louder sound than the other. This works for frequencies from 300 to 5 kilohertz, 300 hertz to 5 kilohertz. And there are several other clues. For example, the shading of the head. The sound gets filtered in a very special way. Depending on the shape of the head, the shape of the pinnae, and in respect to the frequencies, as lower frequencies pass around the head very easily, higher don't. So now I made this little graphic, which surround system is capable to transport these clues. As we have got stereo, which is kind of a spatialization thing too, because we've got sometimes virtual sound in between the two speakers. VBAP, vectorial based amplitude panning, which is an extension of stereo as a surround, where in all these three the stereo principle of amplitude panning is taken to more speakers. What we transport with this system is just the amplitude clues, no phase and no head shading. Binaural, in fact, is very good in transporting all of these clues, but it just works with headphones. And especially good with headphones with head tracking, so that the sound is really stable, although that you move your head, the sound will still come from the same direction. But yeah, it's just for a single listener with headphones. So this was not suitable for me because I wanted to address a larger audience. So we have got ambisonic theory, which transports amplitude and phase clues, as well as the head shading, because as ambisonic creates a sound field which moves across the room, and as the wavefront crosses the head, also some also this head shading happens. And we've got wave field synthesis, which also transports a lot of clues. I'm going into detail that much because this has got direct impact on stability of the transported image. If the less clues are transported, the more unstable the image is. If we transport clues which are coherent, and if we transport several different of them, which work in different parts of the frequency range, we will reach a fairly stable image, which doesn't collapse if we go nearer to the speaker, as does stereo or 5.1 system. And so this is the explanation why it's quite robust, this ambisonic image. Now I put on some pros for ambisonic. The first thing why I think ambisonic is something special is it supports periphony, meaning it supports height. All other systems don't. It can be combined with distance clues of the virtual source, which is important also to get a natural 3D image. The image is stable and precise, we know now why. And the position of the listener is not that important for getting true localization. This is important for several listeners if you want to perform in a hall, something like that. And there's another benefit. If you once encoded the material in your ambisonic encoded files, it's very, very versatile. You can address whatever number of speakers you want. You can decode it to 4 speakers, 6 speakers, maybe 8, 12, 20, as you like, as long as they are equal and symmetric. And this is really what happens if you are performing in different places. Some have got 4 speakers, others have got 8 speakers, and you don't really need to do a new mix every time, but you just decode it and it will be ready in a minute. And the last point, ambisonics is free and it's efficient. So you don't have to buy some machine or gadget to run ambisonics. It's possible to do it, to insert the equations maybe in the stuff you're working with, as the equations are visible in the internet. There's no license on it as far as I know. And so this is a thing, yeah, which goes together with the small budget for arts very well. By the way, it's very efficient, meaning with very little effort, you gain a lot of spatial information and a really impressive image of spatiality. Now, I made a little, a little comparison between the capabilities of different surround systems, and we see stereo, VBAP, surround can not support periphony. It's not good in multiple listeners, it's not stable, and it's not so versatile, because if you change the number of speakers, you've got to do a new remix again. Binaural supports periphony, supports distance clues, but not multiple listeners, as long as you don't hand out several headphones, of course. I should have done point to stability. It's stable, really. And versatile, well, yes. Ambisonic first order and second order, or higher order, supports height, supports distance. The sweet spot is better in second order. I get often asked, what's the difference of higher order? Why should I use higher order? Well, the image is more stable, it's more precise. You will have a larger sweet spot. So I really recommend to do the thing right and use second order or even third. And yeah, you see, stability is better. It's more versatile. Wave field synthesis is very good at all these points, but it even would support height, but you need a large number of speakers. You need at least 30 in a row for an image coming from the front, then you are in the front. If you want all surround, you need about 120 to 300. Now imagine what you needed to include height. So it was not practical for me, and I suppose not practical for many of you. But of course, the image is overwhelming of wave field synthesis. It's really, really good, very precise and very impressive. Now, how do we work with ambisonic? The working with ambisonic splits up in two basic parts. First, we encode the sound, and we will receive an encoded file, and this one we can decode to whatever speaker setup in whatever way we prefer at whatever time. Yeah. Now I guess I should explain a bit about how the encoding works. There are two ways to receive ambisonic format files. We can take a sound field microphone and record them for first order at least, and we can synthesize them. The principle is always the same. The position of the sound is known, and let's presume a sound is up there in the air. The position has got an X, Y, and Z coordinate. And now, as the sound field approaches the listener or the microphone or whatever, we can divide up the direction of this sound field into three components. One for the X direction, the one for the Y direction, and one for the Z direction. And the movement I'm doing here is the movement of a membrane of a microphone, for example. Imagine the sound field, the wave front traveling to this membrane exactly located in X direction. It will move a bit, the Y also, the Z also. If the sound is in front, only the Y membrane will move. The X won't, because sound travels in this direction. The Z membrane won't move at all too, because it's coming directly from the front. And that way we can split up every sound source, let's say also a monophile. If we've got a position in X, Y, and Z component, we can split it up and say, okay, it's coming from here, X component is the monophile in this special, let's say, amount, and Z amount is much smaller, and you will see in the equations soon. What we'll receive then is either four audio tracks for first order. The four come from XYZ, of course, the coordinates, and a W. This W contains all the information like from an omni microphone without without direction. It's just for the general amplitude of the sound. And so we've got four tracks for second order ambisonics. We've got several more. Now imagine we have got X, Y, and Z for first order, and then we stick through other coordinates called R, S, T, U, and another V, which again takes the information, the amplitude information, but directionless. Maybe I don't want to say the wrong thing. Maybe R is the directionless file. Doesn't matter that much. For third order, we've got 15 audio tracks. But as they are stored in the computer, you don't need a 50-channel sound card to put them out. They remain on the hard disk and get processed by decoding, so you just put out the number of channels you want to perform. And yeah, they are stored as separate ordinary WAV files ready to decode. Here's an image I took from the University of York homepage. This shows again the orientation in space, the coordinates, and one thing called A, the angle, and elevation for height. This is how the coordinates can be depicted also. It's just another system apart from X, Y, Z, but it works too. Now, here we've got the encoding equations for first order ambisonic. We've got the cosine of the angle, or the cosine and, not or, and the cosine of the elevation, of course, because you have got to know where the sound should come from to have kind of a trajectory which is transported to this equation, to have this angle and elevation for this moment of encoding. and you simply multiply the input signal, your mono file, with the part of angle and elevation, and you'll receive your four files. The same for second order, then you've got some more equations, and you really can easily put these equations into C sound or Max or something like that to use them. Here we've got them for second order. Yeah. And using these equations, all sounds will be projected on the sphere which is set up by your speaker array. You know, you won't perceive any sounds closer to you or more distant to you by using ambisonic. Ambisonic is, as I said, just for the direction of sound. And of course we want more. And to get more, we will see in the second part. Now, the decoding process is very easy if you start now the spatial information in this bunch of files. You simply assign the proportion of audio signal for every coordinate according to where the speaker is. And you can decode, for example, this spatial information to stereo if you like. Then you reduce it in height, you will reduce it in depth, and you end up in a line between the two speakers. Or you can decode it in a plane with four speakers arranged in a square, with six, hexagon or octagon, as you like. Important is that the speakers are the same and that the layout of the speakers really symmetric. We can decode also to 5.1 by now. Bruce Wiggins from University of Derby just found some equations, so it's possible to assign also to unsymmetric speaker layouts, even in second order, but it's a whole complicated mathematics which just got solved, so you could decode to 5.1 by now, but I personally prefer to stick to the symmetric layout. And as we reach the third dimension, we can decode to a cube of speakers, or 12 speakers, 16, whatever. Put up on position in space. Here we've got some decoding equations taken out from my C sound code. You see that for channel one, sum means in C sound language like add, the components of W, X, Y, Z, S, and V are added by their and multiplied with their special amount. We've got no R and no U, because it's just eight speakers, for proper decoding of second order, we would need at least 12, I would suggest, to catch all the spatial, to transport all the spatial information. But by decoding to 8 speakers in a queue, it's quite impressive still. Although something is missing, it still works very, very good. Now we come to distance perception, which is quite important too. And we will see that distance perception can be well combined with ambisonic and the ambisonic method. So we have got several distance clues. We have got attenuation. The sound gets attenuated as it moves far away from the listener. We've got filtering due to air absorption. The sound gets duller as it moves far away. We've got something like a local reverberation coming from the direction of the sound. And we've got a global reverb, which doesn't really change as the sound moves around. And we've got early reflections, which in fact change a lot as the sound moves around. And as the early reflections change, they produce or they help to perceive distance and locations, location of the sound. It makes it easier to perceive the direction and the position and the distance of a sound if you enrich the spatialization with early reflections, and of course not from coming from a speaker, but coming really from spatial positions too, all around you, distributed ambisonically. So this really helps to improve the perception of depth. Also, the global reverb, where to put a reverb if the sound is all around you, of course, from several positions, like in a usual reverberant situation, all around you. And these reverberant directions can be treated like sound sources itself. Of course, they can come from a position in space. Here we have got the the formula how to attenuate the sound. It's 1 divided through d. D is distance. This is from a book, Computer Music, from Charles Dodge and Thomas Jers. One remark for the practitioner, as sounds move to the distance, to the center, they get infinitely loud, so one should code something that they increase in volume just to a certain point, else your system might get blown. Just this hint. And what we have also, or what we haven't got anymore then, is a definite volume of the sound. So if you're composing in a way that the amplitude is important, you will kind of lose control about the amplitude of your composition as you spatialize your different sounds in the space, because the far ones are now much less loud as the closer ones, and so you have got to take care of that and take this into account. Of course, you can raise the volume of the sounds further away in the composition first, and then it will work. Filtering works just with a low-pass filter, which is fed with parameters of the position of the sound. So the filter, the filter closes the cuts off the high frequencies is the further away the sound is. Local reverb changes also as the sound moves away from the listener, as the global reverb does. And what is important is the ratio between these two, and this is another distance clue. So here we've got the ratios, how they change. If you code this into your spatial environment coding, you can enhance distance perception for another time. Here we've got the pattern of early reflections. They should be in a range between 20 and 50 milliseconds. In this range, they are not perceived as reflection, but as just clarifying perceptual clue. Which helps to describe the position of the sound. The recording with early reflection sounds much more brilliant and transparent. We've got two kinds of early reflections. We've got specular early reflections and diffuse ones. I made some graphic to show the difference. You may code both of them or use both of them. So that you don't not just have six specular reflections coming from every wall and floor and ceiling, but also six diffuse reflections. And as I said, ambisonically distributed is very nice, so that the reflection really comes from a different position according the change of the sound, according the change of the position of the sound, to be precise. That's what it just said. Now, as we are on the Linux conference, there are some things. Maybe here are some programmers for signal processing applications. And as ambisonic is not well known and not very common we should think about how applications can be made capable of being capable to do multi-channel sound or even ambisonic. And one thing is that there should be generally multi-channel output. For example, as far as I know, Audacity hasn't got multi-channel output. You can have several files in your editor window, but they all got mixed to stereo, which I think is a pity. And I think it should be multi-channel. Or what we would need is a non-C sound decoder, because we already have got a C sound decoder, but for people who don't use or like C sound, some application would be nice. Especially for Linux, for Windows we already have.
For Linux also.
Yeah, have we?
We have SuperCollider PD, let's probably use anything more.
Cool. And of course, maybe we one day can get an ambisonic file format, which is common, so everyone knows what to do with these encoded files and just feed them into a decoder, press four channels, decode, and so you don't really have to know about the ambisonic theory and how it does exist. That's good. Yeah, and last not least, I guess more spaces with hype presentation would be nice, because it's not very common to have presentations with height. For example, here in the cube, space could look like as it is set up now, with a dome of height speakers, and it would be so great if the calculations, equations for decoding would be distributed by the owner of the location to people who want to perform their ambisonic stuff there. So, like saying, okay, we've got 20 speakers, they are in that and that position, use these equations to decode and just decode your sound files by these equations, send them and we can play them. This would be very easy to achieve, I guess. So here we are at the end of part one and two. Are there any questions? Okay, so I go on with three. Artistic implications of spatial sound. Something different of spatial sound is that the sound is now detached from the source of the producing source. In ambisonic, you really have got the impression the sound moves freely around without taking care of any speaker, which is quite nice, I think. One can think about how far the separation of a sound from its origin can go. In live acoustic music, we of course have no separation, neither from its origin, the sound producing source, nor temporal separation, because it's not yet recorded, and we haven't got any separation from a reproduction instrument. As we go further in recording acoustic music or doing live electronic music or doing electronic music or spatial electronic music, the detachment, the separation of the sound from its source increases. But what shall we do with the separation now? What can we achieve with spatial sound? What reasons are there for spatialization anyway? So one reason could be to overcome the frontal music presentation, which is I think a bit inappropriate for electronic music as it comes originally from a bunch of people performing on a stage, but in electronic music I don't see any reason why this should be mimicked. We can put movement into music, movement in a spatial way. We can put sounds on trajectories. We can have a choreography of sounds. So this is a parameter which may enrich the music. Also, the position of the sound is another parameter. You can work with this in an architectonic way, or you can play the game of detachment of virtual sound from its origin, virtuality. You can make compositions which take into account the relativity of parameters like amplitude and frequency, because also frequency changes if the sound moves around. If you put in some Doppler effect device, you can nicely play with this and make compositions solo with amplitude and frequency changes in respect to the position of the sound and its its speed. And of course you can use the spatial sound to overlap the reality with virtual sound. I remember having listened to some artworks of Janet Cardiff, who does this in a very lovely way. There was an artwork in London where one got binaural headphones on and walked through London, and you could still perceive the sounds of the East End of London, and some binaural sounds were mixed into the sound image from her. So you got you get an overlap of reality with virtual reality, which can be something to experiment with. If you work with spatial sound, you will have to deal with problems or questions you won't have to deal with if you do it in mono. So you've got to depict where the sound shall have its location on every time. Every sound has to have a location then. And so this is one more step in work. You have to be conscient in this, that you really build trajectories along with the score where the sound should be. This is one more working step. Also, you can think about which dimension the sound should have. Should it be a point source, or you can also widen and broaden up the image so that it changes in size. You have to decide, is it a static source or shall it move? And if it moves, where shall it move to? How shall it move? What is the movement like? What behavior? I mean, everything that moves, moves in a special way, according to its character, according to its mass, according to the laws of gravity, whatever. You really can use these things to depict a sound, and to give the sound a special behavior. And of course you may think about what is the meaning of movement, what is the meaning of some environment you create, what do you want to transport with it. Yeah, and also if you've got several sound sources interacting with each other, what is the relation between them? What happens as they change their position? How does the movement develop in time? Do sounds interact by moving? You come to create things start to get kind of choreography while you're working with moving sounds. I think this is very intriguing. And of course, one might think about how can I relate the concept of the movement or of the position to the general concept of the composition. So these are interesting questions to ask. And with these, I will now close my little lecture. Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes.
I wanted to ask about the size of this sweet spot.
Okay.
And how it's related to frequency, and if it's better to use a higher dome.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not higher, but bigger.
Okay. The size of the sweet spot is actually very small, especially for first order. It's not bigger than, let's say, this for a setup, or if the speakers are 4 meters apart, or for second order, let's say, this size, and then you're good. So this may disappoint you, but the cool thing about ambisonic is that it doesn't collapse rapidly as you move out of the center. So people which are pretty close to the speakers still can perceive what the other speakers are doing. So the image is still stable. If you move your head into the sweet spot, you'll get even more enlightened, of course, but it works also for a larger audience. And you even perceive the image where the sound is if you stand outside the speaker array. It's quite impressive, yeah. And the size, well, size doesn't matter. You can put ambisonic in very small setups, you can put it in very large setups. I haven't done so many different listening tests, although I performed in small rooms and large rooms, but the room characteristic or the characteristic of the speaker is more important than the size of the room, so I didn't notice really what the difference of smaller and larger rooms is. For me it was okay also in large rooms.
Mm-hmm. If I may add one thing to this, in a small room, mm-hmm. you really have to take account of the fact that it is small. You need a compensation for the distance at low frequencies. And otherwise it will not really work very well.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
In a small room,
yeah.
You need a compensation for the at low frequencies for the small distance.
And because the wavelength is
yes,
too long.
Yeah. And if you don't do that, then it doesn't really work very good.
But how can one compensate?
It's just a high pass filter in XYZ.
Okay.
Different signals.
So, but you cut off then some low frequency?
It's not cut off, it's very gentle. It's,
okay.
It's the same effect as you have with a microphone, with a finger width microphone. If
I
you
see.
Come too close, you get too much bass.
Mm.
It's not the fault of the microphone, it's
mm-hmm.
the fault of the source.
Ah, yeah.
Of the speaker effect. So you have to compensate that for the speaker, if it's too close.
I see. Yeah, thank you.
And in a room like this, it doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
If you have speakers like this very close, uh-huh. 1 meter, 2 meters, then it does matter.
Okay.
Well, is it possible to improve the size of the sweet spot by adding a bunch of speakers or adding a lot of speakers to
yes.
the setup?
Yes, yes.
So you got a break?
Just wait a minute, I've got to think. At least as small as you increase the number of speakers, the spatial image gets clearer. Uh-huh. But as far as I know, you don't increase the size of the sweet spot, you just increase the clarity of the image. You can increase the size of the sweet spot by moving to third, fourth, whatever order. This is the way to increase the sweet spot. But if you go up in order, you need more speakers. You can't reproduce, let's say, fifth order with five speakers. Also, it's far too less. Yeah.
What is the proper amount of speakers for 20?
Yeah, there are equations which or rules which propose how many speakers you need. For first order, you can easily for square decoding go with four speakers. For second order, you should have six at least. Just for square. For first order with height, you can go easily with eight speakers in a cube. For second order, you should have at least 12. But I run my system at home with eight speakers, it's fine. So if you're not that keen on the cutting edge, it will work also second order with eight speakers fine, and yeah, and you can improve it with 12. Mm-hmm. Any more questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Victor, let's look at the equations. Show me what you mean.
No, I saw the equations. I just called out because it's C and
Do you mean the decoding?
I think it's the decoding.
Encoding?
Yeah, I think it's the decoding, because that's where you have the cosine.
Yeah.
Go to first one. Somehow I thought that one of these signals had to be real and imaginary parts, and then combine, one of these would be, and then there will be another term here, see, the signal to that, and then you sum to another term here, so this will be the real part, and then we have the imaginary part there, and this will be the real part, and the imaginary part.
Let's go to the second order, maybe it was.
What's the name of this?
Just the cosines. You just have one input signal.
Yeah.
So the thing was something like this. It's one of the times when I was surfing the net, to read about this, and I saw these equations, and you got the pen?
Yes, I have. Here you are.
Something like this. So you have something like this. You have X would be something. The real part, real input. Sine of A plus sine of B plus imaging two times sine of A times sine of B. Something like that. There will be another term here.
I've never seen that. And what does it mean?
This is the signal. Effectively, what you do here is that you transform the signal into that you use in C sound you would use a Hilbert filter.
Which
shifts my degrees. So this signal is this signal is 90 degrees shifted to that. So I remember. Everyone might be wrong. It's been a while, and I don't know anything about this. So that's why I was wondering whether you knew anything about this.
No, I don't. Definitely.
Do you know any? I couldn't find a good reference for the theory in terms of books. Is there a good book?
No, but there are papers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Dave Malham and Richard Furst made several papers.
Mm-hmm.
And the founder of the ambisonic theory, Michael Gerson.
I would search there for theory. So that would be a good reference, I suppose. There's a book in this. Someone needs to write a book about this.
Yeah, I do agree. I would appreciate that.
Because then, it's a good way of teaching it. Anyway, thanks. See you later.
See you.